Keep her up, guys. 1,500 till south of runway 27. Cessna final, you're doing a great job. Put her down, pink dot, runway 18 right, clear left.
Welcome into today's audiocast from on location at EAA AirVenture 2007 for this Tuesday, July 24th from AvWeb. Brought to you by Oregon Aero and the Bose Aviation Headset 10. In today's AirVenture coverage, Eclipse CEO Vern Rayburn talks with AvWeb's Mary Grady about the new Eclipse single-engine concept jet, which made its surprise debut on Monday at EAA AirVenture in Oshkosh. Rayburn gives his opinions regarding composite versus aluminum, the advantages of a go-home button versus a parachute, his take on the safety of flying at 41,000 or 25,000 feet, and more.
We've taken more of a page out of the automotive industry in the sense of this is really a concept. This is not a launch program or an approved program, or this is not an airplane that we're committing to go out and build. We're not taking orders for it, and so we're not playing the game of I've got so many deposits, none of which are real because they're all refundable anyway. It really is to go out and both kind of show ourselves what we can do with all of our technology and with all of our equipment and everything we've developed so far to date, and combine that with putting kind of, if you will, really meat on the bones as opposed to just yet another plastic mock-up that, customers can look at, potential customers can look at and say, I like that, I don't like that, I really like that, I really don't like that, whatever the case may be. So it gives us a chance really to understand what the marketplace wants to have in the airplane at a point in time when it's a very, very easy thing for us to modify the design. I think in terms of this market segment, this emerging single-engine jet market segment, the choices are becoming very clear and very, very interesting in the sense of pretty much all the other airplanes that are out there today from the real companies, the companies that have the ability to actually certify an airplane, companies like Diamond and Piper and Cirrus, those airplanes are all, they've gone a way that historically the market hasn't really endorsed, which is they're really large airplanes for their category. I mean, obviously a Cirrus isn't an A380 or something like that. That's not the point. The point is that within their specific category, their specific size, they're very large aircraft. And I think that aviation through the decades has been pretty resounding in the reality of it's been the smaller, more efficient, better performing aircraft that historically has prevailed in the marketplace. There's a couple of exceptions where there's extenuating circumstances or factors to, but all the way from like even the Bombardier Challenger, took them a very, very long time to even come close to Gulfstream, even though they had a much, much larger cabin. And it just turned out people didn't buy the larger cabin in and of itself, and that goes all the way down to like, oh, I remember the Aero Commander 112, which was the wide-body single-engine airplane that was a financial and marketing disaster for Rockwell. So we've taken a very different approach, and that's what the marketplace is about, to provide people choice, and it's going to be very, very interesting. We think there's a couple other aspects to that particular issue, which is there's zero debate, there's zero question that we are entering an era, we're well into it, of a very high price fuel. And in fact, it's only going to get worse. And anyone for a moment thinks that it doesn't is really just seriously kidding themselves. There's zero doubt in my mind that probably sometime this year, and certainly sometime in the next couple of years, worst case, we're going to see $6 a gallon Jet A. And that's suddenly going to make fuel efficiency really, really important, especially for the owner-operators, for the individuals on their airplane. Because even though we all kid about the $500 hamburgers, the reality is that every dollar that you spend is a dollar that comes out of your pocket. It's not a company paying for it. It's not passengers that are paying for it. And so we think efficiency, and we've certainly learned this from our 500 customers, they've told us resoundingly, emphatically, that one of the reasons they choose the Eclipse 500 over something like a Mustang or any of the other airplanes is because of the operating costs, the projected operating costs. And in these small jets, fuel constitutes a huge percentage, of way more than half of the overall operating costs of the airplane. So we think being in a very, very fuel-efficient design is going to be a really interesting place to be, especially a couple of years from now. So you put all that together, and it's what we came up with today. And again, like I say, this is the opportunity for us to find out if our ideas are congruent with or, you know, in sync with the marketplace's ideas. And from there, then we'll start to make some decisions about how and if we go forward with this particular project. In terms of, you asked specifically about a parachute. We think that the parachute as a concept is really interesting, but we don't think it's a slam dunk in this following sense. You have to do backup, and this is just basic good engineering, and say, what's the problem we're trying to solve here with the parachute? And is the parachute the best solution to that problem? And our statement of the problem is we don't consider mid-airs to be something that you solve for. Alan Klatmeyer loves to talk about the mid-air that he was in an ultralight. Comparing ultralights to jets is an interesting idea, but a bit of a stretch. And we think that the idea of mechanical failure is so rare in aircraft today that it's... If you have it happen to you, it sucks, but you know, it just doesn't happen that often statistically. So really the parachute comes down to, and there's no other way to put this, there's no nice way to put it, it's for stupid pilots who are inadequately trained or not proficient or not current, and it's their ultimate, you know, save my ass type of solution. Having said that, that's really the problem, which is how do you handle a pilot who can't pilot the aircraft? Whether it's because of lack of skill and proficiency, or it's because for some reason or other they become incapacitated. And we think the incapacitation problem is a real problem, particularly for single pilot aircraft, and particularly for owner flown aircraft. And so that's more the problem statement, is how do you recover the aircraft when you have a pilot, for whatever reason, is incapable of doing what they're supposed to. And when you think about it that way, there's other alternatives that present themselves. A parachute is definitely one, although in a jet, we think the technical challenges of having a parachute that can truly, you know, provide that recovery becomes really huge, because as everybody knows in the Cirrus, which is the best aircraft that we have today for this, the deployment envelope for the parachute is extremely limited. And in fact, there have been several deployments where the chute didn't work because they were outside that envelope. The risk of being outside that envelope, particularly in the stupid pilot trick category, in a jet is significantly greater. And so it provides, unfortunately, I think, in a jet, unless you're prepared to go to a very, very heavy and very, very expensive system, which, I mean, and let's face facts, we used to deploy parachutes on the Apollo capsule at Mach 12. So it's not that it can't be done, but the Apollo parachute recovery system weighed more than these airplanes weigh. And so... almost more, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but just a little. So it really comes down to, is a parachute going to be an effective recovery method? We look a different direction, which is we look more into the world of UAV technology and unmanned or unpiloted aerial vehicles, and the extraordinarily rapid advances of technology in that area are so compelling. I mean, anybody in the Air Force will tell you that within no more than about a decade and a half or two decades, the era of piloted combat aircraft is going to be starting to come to a close. And it just, you know, these silly bags of protoplasm called pilots, you know, they can't sustain more than 9G turns. And we can design structures and aerodynamic control systems that can produce 25G turns without any problem today. And so if the objective in combat is to kill the other guy before he kills you, the best way to do that is get the pilot out of the airplane. And that's pretty well accepted now in the armed services. And so that technology, when you have an aircraft like the Eclipse, which is an all-digital aircraft, the flight control system is digitally controlled, all the systems are digitally controlled, it's a really, 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 really short step to a sort of a get-me-home type of system. And the only thing that's missing from the Eclipse 500 today are electric brakes, because today that's the one hydraulic system we have left on the airplane, and electric steering. Both of those systems are reasonably easy to add to the airplane. An autoland system, whether it's an autonomous or remotely piloted autoland system, is an easy thing to do. So we're not arguing with the need for some type of recovery system. We're just not convinced that the parachute is the best approach to that recovery system.
Next, Eclipse CEO Vern Rayburn talks about the safety of flying and the various flight levels. Today's coverage from Oshkosh is presented by the Bose Aviation Headset 10. Voted number one for the sixth consecutive year in Professional Pilots 2006 Headset Preference Survey. Enjoy full spectrum noise reduction, clearer audio, and comfortable around-the-ear fit. Learn more at Bose.com/headset. Oregon Aero now offers the complete solution to painful, noisy aviation headsets with new headset upgrade kits. Oregon Aero headset upgrade kits eliminate pain and pressure, improve intelligibility, and keep the head and ears cool and dry. Visit OregonAero.com to select a headset upgrade kit today.
And then I think you asked me also about 25,000 versus 41,000. We think this is the biggest red herring that you could possibly ever concoct. And it's the classic example of when you have lemons make lemonade, because it's really an excuse for shortfall in performance. And the excuse is this, that somehow or another you can't die as much at 25,000 as you can at 41,000, which is at best a fantasy and at worst just an outright, you know, gross misrepresentation. There's no statistical data to support that whatsoever. Combined with, you know, personally, I've spent over 3,000 hours at 25,000 feet because I've flown pressurized piston aircraft and turboprops, and probably closer to 4,000 hours now that I think about it. And you know what? 25,000 is just about the worst place in the world to be because at that altitude, you're not below the weather where you can see your way around stuff, and you're not above the weather. You're right in the middle of the weather. And in fact, you're right in the middle of the worst weather, which is the tops of small thunderstorms and the bellies of big thunderstorms. And those are both really, really bad places to be. And unfortunately, at 25,000, the likelihood of you flying into an embedded thunderstorm, you know, your IMC, you're in the clouds and blundering along without really being able to use the old Mark I eyeball to actually help you figure out when to turn left or turn right. And radar and XM weather are really good proxies and substitutes for your eyeball, but they still aren't as good as your eyeball. And being stuck at 25,000 really puts you into the middle of that stuff. So we categorically reject the idea that somehow insurance is going to be cheaper or it's going to be safer, it's going to be easier. High-speed aerodynamics are not an issue in these kinds of airplanes. These are all straight-wing airplanes. You don't have a coffin corner at 41,000 in these airplanes because of the way the wings are. They're not swept-wing airplanes. The way the modern turbofan engines work, you've got lots of surge capacity, lots of surge margin. So this whole concept of 41,000 is somehow or another more dangerous than 25,000 is founded in just, you know, fantasy and not fact. And so that's one piece of this that we just categorically rejected. Now, for somebody coming from 8,000 feet, I can understand them saying, oh my gosh, you know, I want to take one step. I only want to go up 20,000 feet instead. But you find out really, 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 really fast that it doesn't buy you anything. In fact, the number of times I've been stuck at 25,000 just wishing like heck I could get above 30 is more than I even want to remember or think about. So that's what we're saying, is we want to give people the option. We're not necessarily saying we expect people to operate regularly in the high 30s, but we certainly want to give them the ability to get up there if they need to or they'd like to. And that's what ultimately I think the best products in the marketplace do, is they provide customers the most choice.
What about composite versus aluminum?
Well, composite versus aluminum will be, it's a little bit like the abortion debate. You're never going to be right no matter what you say. But I think that composites, and we've never said that composites are bad, quite the opposite. Our position has been that composites, for where they are in the current state of the art, do not represent a big advantage. From a startup company standpoint, it's easier to put an aircraft in production using composites because the tooling costs are significantly lower than to achieve the same results in aluminum. There's no doubt that if you want to try to create a nicely shaped and smooth surface airplane in aluminum, it takes a heck of a lot more investment than it does in a composite aircraft. Having said that, though, getting to rate or getting to high production levels is much harder with a compositor. Again, not impossible. Cirrus, you know, is doing a great job of building 700-plus airplanes a year right now, and it's obviously an all-composite aircraft. But that's where the other problem kicks in, which is a combination of strength to weight. Even though the material system is inherently stronger than aluminum, historically the FAA has not allowed designers to take advantage of that extra strength. And in reality, most of the all-composite aircraft, in fact, all the all-composite aircraft are heavier than their aluminum equivalents, and that's just because of the safety margins that the FAA imposes. Now, Boeing, with the 787 work, is changing that, and so I think in the next few years, this is something we'd have to relook at. The other component of composites, and this is, in my view, a pretty serious problem, is it's a material system that it's difficult to decide if it's failing. Aluminum, it's what I would call an honest material. When it fails, you see cracks, you see corrosion. You know, you can detect failure in aluminum pretty easily. Combined with, we've been doing this for, 70 years now. So we know the system and we know how it fails. Composites are kind of sneaky. You can have internal delamination, you can have hygroscopic absorption, which is a much bigger issue for jets than it is for piston airplanes, because jets, you know, will see huge temperature excursions. It's not unusual in a jet flight to go from a plus 40 C to a minus 60 C. That's 100 degrees C temperature swing, and that causes, condensation, that causes huge stress on a material that's trying to act as a homogeneous material, but is in reality a whole bunch of strands of fiber sort of held in loose formation with each other. And they want to revert back to their individuality. And so when you get those kinds of failures, the strength degradation of composites is very nonlinear. And as a result, when you start to have a structural failure in composites, it can happen both in a way that's very, very difficult to detect, and it's very nonlinear in its failure. Whereas aluminum structures, we know how to design them to be relatively linear, not completely, but relatively linear in their failure modes. And so as a result, you get gradual degradation of strength as opposed to instantaneous degradation of strength. So the composite question is still an interesting one. For the concept jet, we could very well end up going to composites on certain parts, including structural parts, which is something we've not done before. But it's one of those trade decisions that we would put a lot of effort into making, and we have not made that decision yet.
So if you were going to look ahead 5 or 10 years where Eclipse will be, like your gut feeling of the market and these different airplanes, what do you see as your biggest airplane at that point in time?
That's a really good question, and I do not have a really good answer. And the reason I don't is certainly my previous career in the technology business, and the PC business, taught me one lesson, which is if you're truly doing an innovative or disruptive or game-changing product, predicting what's going to happen is a fool's errand, because you won't know. Because the coolest thing that happens when you come up with something that's really new, that's really different, is people come up with ways to use it that you've never, ever thought of once in your life. And that's, for me, as an entrepreneur and an innovator, is just about the neatest thing in the world when I see people take our product and do something with it that we never even said, what if somebody did this? And there's going to be so many fundamental changes with these airplanes. This is not just, second verse same as the first in terms of, some people have called Learjet the original VLJ. That's kind of a stupid statement given the original Learjet was 12,500 pounds. And if Bill Lear were selling that airplane today, it cost about $3 million in now year economics. This is a genuinely new category. The best way to think about this is the Eclipse 500 is metaphorically more like a 400 series Cessna in the 70s in terms of price, but with performance that's about almost 100% better and operating costs that are less. And that's, I don't care how you think about it, better performance, less operating costs, significantly less acquisition cost even in today's dollars versus then year dollars, that's a game changer. And I don't know how to predict game changing products, except to say it'll be different than we think it is, and that'll be fun.
Eclipse CEO Vern Rayburn speaking on location at EAA AirVenture with AvWeb's Mary Grady about the new Eclipse single-engine concept jet, which made its surprise debut on Monday in Oshkosh. Hey, if you're attending AirVenture this week in Oshkosh, be sure and stop by the AvWeb booth and say hello. We'll be signing up folks at booths 105 through 108 in the vendor hangars throughout the show, and we'd love to meet some of our readers. We'll be producing news reports live from the booth, and some of our most frequent contributors have agreed to do special one-hour stints in the booth, so if you'd like to put some faces with the names, be sure and stop by and talk to us. Today's coverage from On Location at Oshkosh, Wisconsin was brought to you by Oregon Aero and the Bose Aviation Headset 10. For AvWeb Audio, I'm Mike Blakeney reporting. Thanks for listening.